Welcome to the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Muck. That's what they call it. Farmers and environmentalists alike. Muck. It's a word thought to be of Scandinavian origin. Here in South Florida, it's the source from which grows the sugarcane industry. Muck. It's the moist, black, pungent soil of the Everglades agricultural area south of Lake Okeechobee in Palm Beach County, dug up after the area was drained, and what has emerged is a driving economic, political, and environmental force, sugarcane.
The yield in terms of the sweetness of the cane is pretty good, but the cane did not grow as good as normal this summer because it was cloudy and rainy. Obviously, we're talking about photosynthesis here, so if you don't have as much sunlight during the what we call it in the summer, the grand growth period, where it grows over an inch a week, it did not do that, so the tons are just not there.
That's Rick Roth. He's a second generation Palm Beach County sugar farmer. We rode around some of the 2,800 acres of cane he grows. We drove around the muck. And this is as good a place as any to begin with sugar in South Florida, in the cab of a pickup truck, looking at the world of cane through a windshield.
The productivity out of those acres has been down.
Yeah, we're talking probably a 7 or 8% reduction.
Has that impacted hiring? Has that impacted the economics of your operation?
Yeah, I think it does for every sugar farmer. What I've decided to do, and I think most farmers have decided to do that this year, is we've been trying to maximize our tons of cane the last 3 years because of high prices of sugar. Now we're backing off of our planting schedules and planting a little bit less and trying to get back into a normal rotation. Some farmers, one thing you can do as a farmer in Belglade, you can take land out of sugarcane production in November and plant it back in sugarcane again in December, trying to increase your tons for next year. This is a good year to not do that. Instead, rotate your land into something else and then plant it in sugarcane a year later and figure that you're going to get a higher yield a year later by waiting. So people are doing that, yeah.
When you compare the cane that you're harvesting now over, say, the past five harvesting cycles, how does it compare for you and for the outlook that you've got for the next 5 years?
One of the good things about growing sugarcane is it really is a limited market. You can't grow sugarcane 200 miles from a sugar mill. You have to grow it close enough. So there is some economic advantages to staying with the business. Even if you lose money 1 or 2 years in a row, you got to look at the long term. One of the things you think about as a farmer, and this is why I grow radishes in Belglade, why I grow parsley in Belglade, why I grow sweet corn and green beans in Belglade, is I know that I can grow it cheaper than other growing regions. So if we're all getting the same price, then I should be sustainable. I should be able to be the one that can stay in. Somebody else is going to have to get out.
You want to be the low-cost provider.
Yeah, if you're the lowest-cost provider, then you should be able to be sustainable, and somebody else is going to... It's kind of like playing chicken. Somebody's going to have to blink, and you're hoping it's the other guy, and we are the lowest-cost cane producer in the United States, in Florida, due to our size. And size is the most important thing.
Driving through the fields with sugarcane farmer Rick Roth. We'll return to him in a moment, but he touches upon two of the biggest issues surrounding sugar in South Florida, the economics and the natural environment.
Eric Eichenberg, CEO of the Everglades Foundation.
The Everglades Foundation is one of several environmental groups watching and monitoring the sugar industry. Its mission is, quote, protecting and restoring America's Everglades, end quote.
The beautiful thing about it is we both enjoy America's Everglades. They're using it they're there producing a crop and employing folks. We are also advocating that these projects that provide jobs as well are implemented so that we can maintain the vitality of this ecosystem.
The projects Eichenberg refers to include stormwater treatment areas and improving the flow of water through the central Everglades. The foundation's mission statement is straightforward to that goal, saying, quote, "The Everglades and the surrounding estuaries will be restored to a natural state that allows clean water to flow while providing a reliable water supply for the people of Florida."
Is the agriculture community generally and the sugar industry included in the future of your view of the Everglades?
Well, agriculture in particular. There is a future for ag in the state of Florida.
Does that include the Everglades area?
When you look at today, yes. And again, tomorrow, yes, as well. So I don't know when all that takes place. There was a few years ago, one of the companies was looking to get out of the business. That's changed a little bit now as far as based on the economy. But they're there. The industry's there now. They're operating today. But when you look at agriculture and the impact it has on our state economy, it is a tremendous impact. And ag, I know, should be protected, and there's those that advocate for that. Within ag itself, I think some would debate the impact that sugar does have. But overall, we're working with agriculture. We feel that part of the solution when we deal with northern Everglades issues, the agricultural industry plays a key role going forward. And we're excited about the partnerships and the opportunities that we've been forging north of the lake.
Should the Everglades revert back to pre-20th century conditions?
No, I don't know. I don't think we'll ever have that opportunity. But we can. We can implement projects that restore that flow. It's a water quantity issue as much as a water quality issue. And soon we're going to be the third largest state in the union. We're back to a growth state. And as people come to Florida and the migration of people leaving California, New York, and they come here because of our waterways, because of our recreational opportunities, because of the Everglades. And if we're gonna maintain that market share, if you will, you have to ensure that you have the proper water supply. So by growing that pie, and not just inserting new straws in the existing water supply, we have to grow it. And when we talk about comprehensive water policy, we have to ensure that the Everglades gets its fair share of water. Because folks live along the coast and they understand the need to grow.
Their definition of restoring the Everglades is different than mine.
Back in sugarcane farmer Rick Roth's pickup truck.
My definition is there's 1.5 million acres of Everglades National Park, there's 800,000 acres of conservation areas, and there's 600,000 acres of farmland. So, you know, 30% is being farmed, the rest is kind of in a water storage state, Everglades. And my definition of restoration is you're cleaning the water up to the way it almost as clean as what it was 100 years ago, and therefore we can have a thriving environmental system, water storage system, good for the Everglades, good for Everglades National Park, good for the urban population, good for agriculture, and still produce $2 billion worth of food.
This tension between growers and environmental groups was tested this past summer. Rainstorms in May collected in Lake Okeechobee, raising the lake level to dangerous levels, leading the Army Corps of Engineers, the agency in charge of the lake, to release its polluted waters into estuaries on its east and west sides. The water that was released included chemicals and fertilizers like nitrogen and phosphorus from farms, ranches, and golf courses. The water streamed into the St. Lucie River estuary and the Indian River Lagoon, fueling algae blooms. Those blooms clouded the water, upset the natural balance between fresh water and salt water, and led to a state Senate Select Committee hearing.
We can win the fight if it's based on the science. What makes it so difficult for us is nobody hardly ever talks about the science. It's more of a perception. It's a more of an emotional decision. If we can make decisions based on science, we can protect the environment, we can protect the Everglades, and grow more food. And I tell people all the time, can I tell you how sugarcane is saving the Everglades? Because it's a crop that uses so little fertilizer compared to vegetables, loves water, so therefore does not have to be drained immediately after a 2-inch rain, whereas a lettuce crop will die in 24 hours if you don't drain the fields. So sugarcane is contributing almost 0% of the phosphorus going down to the Everglades, and that's 80% of the land use.
The amount of fertilizer that is placed on those sugar farms, the volume of that fertilizer, and then when water is added to it, it produces nutrients, phosphorus, nitrogen, pollution that has to then be dealt with.
Again, Eric Eichenberg with the Everglades Foundation.
The fact is, the water that comes from the lake is dirty. That lake water is polluted. But the sheer amount of fertilizer and issues that they or nutrients that they place to grow crop adds to it.
When the sugar grower says it's the vegetable grower that's really causing the bulk of the fertilizer pollution in Everglades water, you're saying that's not necessarily the case?
Yeah, see, it's quick to point fingers. I mean, the majority of production that happens within that Everglades agricultural area just south of the lake, this 487,000 acres I'm mentioning, is sugar. It's sugar cane production. Yes, there's vegetable in there, but just sheer amount of fertilizer that sugar uses, it equates to large numbers of pollution. And that's what we're trying to deal with.
We understand as farmers in the greatest country in the world that if we go into public disfavor and the public decides that the agriculture is not sustainable because there's too many environmental problems, we will disappear. We do farm in this country with the blessing of the American consumer. I don't see myself picking up my farm and moving to a different state. It doesn't quite work that way. So we have got to stay and fight the fight and protect our right to farm in probably the best place to farm in the United States, if not the whole world, because of our capitalistic economy.
The Everglades needs clean water, and it's costly. You have to work with a diverse group of people. And when all those parties come to a table, yes, it would be easy to say we're going to put all of our attention to the various projects and we're going to fund it, and there's going to be shared adversity in how that's funded. Sometimes that doesn't work. So you just have to deal with the partners or the stakeholders that are at the table at that time with the hope that the progress is moving forward. So, for example, in years past, we've actually worked with the sugar industry when it comes to lobbying for key dollars coming out of Washington. In Tallahassee, we've worked with them on appropriations.
Eric Eichenberg, leader of the Everglades Foundation, and Rick Roth, sugarcane grower in Palm Beach County, both are familiar with the political muscle of sugar. It is one of the biggest special interests in Tallahassee. After all, more sugar is grown in Florida than anywhere else in the country, and a lot of it in Florida comes from Palm Beach County. Political science professor Susan McManus at the University of South Florida in Tampa says the sugar industry has done very well at getting legislation passed or preventing some bills from going through. But she says so have other agriculture industries that spend big money on campaigns and lobbying efforts.
Historically, big sugar has meant big bucks for politicians running for office. In Florida, it has been an industry that has very much been involved in trying to influence the political process legally through PACs and other contributions. But special interest to one person means an advocacy group to another, so the semantics of it make a difference.
WLRN Miami Herald reporter Gina Jordan in Tallahassee spoke with Brian Hughes, spokesman for Florida Sugar Farmers. That's a coalition of growers, including the giants, U.S. Sugar Corporation, and Florida Crystals.
Both directly and indirectly, about 13,000 people are employed in or close to Florida sugar farming interests here in the state of Florida, and that results in about $3.1 billion of economic impact in Florida's agriculture sector.
Generally speaking, environmental groups are critical of the sugar industry. One of your critics is Alan Farrago, president of Friends of the Everglades. He says the sugar industry is one of the most entitled and wealthiest entities influencing American politics.
One of the chief ways the sugar industry gets what it wants is through the exercise of authority by the state's water management districts, which are also the only science and only taxing authority that is specifically targeted to Everglades restoration. There's virtually no piece of Everglades restoration that can proceed without the sugar industry's endorsement. In fact, it is not an exaggeration to say that the entire Everglades restoration effort is a workaround of Big Sugar.
Is there anything you can say to respond to that?
Well, first, there are undoubtedly critics of sugar farming that call themselves environmental advocates. I would point to the fact that in, for example, a major piece of legislation last year, we worked hand in hand with the Everglades Foundation and Florida Audubon to help craft a bill that is now law that will enshrine really the final phase of Everglades restoration. So on the bigger picture, yes, we work at both the federal and state level with policymakers to ensure that there's good agriculture policy that allows us to remain a vibrant part of both the state and nation's economy.
Florida Sugar Farmers spokesman Brian Hughes. Now, you heard him mention what he called, quote, the final phase of Everglades restoration, end quote. That's a characterization, though, that environmentalists like Eric Eichenberg of the Everglades Foundation bristle at.
They claim to be partners in this. They also say we're entering in the final phase of restoration. I mean, go talk to the people living on the coast of Florida. We are nowhere near the final phase. We're into the next phase, which the next phase and maybe the phase after that will get us to that final point.
Still to come, the economics of sugar and the government guarantee for growers.
We're being paid less for sugar today than in 1980. You want to go, but would you like to buy a Ford pickup for 1980 prices? That'd be really nice, right? It's not a subsidy. It's a price support.
This is the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. The Agricultural Act of 2014 is better known as the Farm Bill. It stretches hundreds of pages, and while only a few dozen words deal directly with sugarcane, those few words are very valuable for growers and processors. Section 1301 of the law continues a government loan program that effectively guarantees growers a minimum price per pound of sugar. The government, through the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, promises to loan sugar processors money, loans backed by the sugar itself. The loan, set at 18¾ cents per pound of raw cane sugar, which was set back in the 2008 Farm Bill. From Washington, Matt Laszlo reports, while South Florida lawmakers support the nation's sugar program, they are bracing for changes down the road.
The recently enacted Farm Bill included major reforms for the nation's farmers. Well, most of them, that is. It ended direct crop subsidies and replaced them with taxpayer-supported crop insurance. It also cut food stamps by around $8 billion. While those changes garnered bipartisan support, the sugar industry was protected by a bipartisan coalition. From the perch of most South Florida lawmakers, that's a great thing. Democratic Congressman Alcee Hastings says the sugar program is vital for South Florida's economy.
A lot of people do not know, for example, machinists and truck drivers that work in the sugar industry number close right in Florida to about 15,000. And most of those people are making $60,000 or $70,000 a year.
Besides jobs, Florida lawmakers, like Democratic Senator Bill Nelson, argue comparing the sugar program to other commodities is comparing apples to, well, sugar.
Sugar industry has a different kind of thing. It's not a normal kind of agricultural support program. It's a different thing. It's pegged to the world market price.
Congressman Hastings says he's seen up close how other countries prop up their sugar industries.
And I have had the opportunity to visit other countries that have subsidized their industries and are now claiming otherwise. For example, Australia and India. They are just waiting for the subsidies to be modified here in this country. And I promise you the sugar prices will go up.
But critics argue the sugar program costs consumers more than $3 billion annually by inflating prices at the grocery store, which they contend costs 20,000 jobs each year. They also say only 5,000 sugar growers benefit from the national program. New Hampshire Democratic Senator Jean Shaheen lost her floor battle to reform the sugar program. She says the program doesn't pass the common sense test.
And it requires the government in some cases, I mean, this is what's really outrageous. It requires the government to buy sugar off the market and then sell it to ethanol plants at a loss to taxpayers.
Critics say the industry is so well protected because the sugar lobby is such an active force here on Capitol Hill. The chairman of the House Agriculture Committee, Frank Lucas of Oklahoma, was lobbied hard from all sides while crafting the nearly 1,000-page bill.
I deal with every group from every perspective on these issues, whether it's a general farm commodities group, National Farmers Union, Farm Bureau, the cattlemen, the packers, the feeders, every perspective. I would just simply tell you, if anything, you can go through the Farm Bill and you can pick out the groups who work the hardest and have worked the longest to achieve relationships.
South Florida Republican Congressman Mario Diaz-Balart says he understands the argument for ending supports for sugar growers. But he says the U.S. shouldn't do it alone.
Look, if they stop subsidizing it, then we should stop these guarantees, but should we unilaterally disarm?
Diaz-Balart says he's open to reforming the program.
I am always open to looking at any policy to make sure that whatever policy we're looking at, whether it's been there for a long time or not, that it still makes sense, that it still works, that it's still efficient.
The nation is saddled with more than $17 trillion in debt, which means further spending cuts, tax increases, or program reforms are coming. That's why Congressman Hastings says the sugar industry and every other interest group ought to prepare now for future changes.
So toward that end, the subsidies at some point in the future will be modified, and there is no question about it, just as will the so-called entitlements be modified in some way. Otherwise, our present state of being is unsustainable.
While he awaits those changes, Hastings also warns critics of the sugar program not to move too quickly.
There are people that are terribly dissatisfied with, quote, the sugar industry, unquote. But I notice that they keep putting sugar in their coffee.
I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
You know, the price supports for American sugar, for Florida sugar, are safe for now. Second-generation Palm Beach County grower Rick Roth is quick to point out the price of sugar today is about half of what it was a generation ago.
We're being paid less for sugar today than in 1980. And I jokingly tell people, you want to go, but would you like to buy a Ford pickup for 1980 prices? That'd be really nice, right? So the bottom line is, it's not a subsidy. It's a price support. But price support, nobody knows what that means. It's not as sexy.
Well,
so just say subsidy. But look, when you're in a debate, your choice of words really is important. When you're using a word blanket approach, subsidy, that can mean anything to anybody. So let's define subsidy. A subsidy in rice production in America is paying a farmer to grow less than 90% of his normal supply. If you grow 92% of your base acreage, they will pay you a subsidy. They will give you money not to plant that other 8%. That's a subsidy.
So the idea there is trying to control supply. Limit supply,
right,
as demand continues and
right,
you get rid of the glut of the product and prices naturally
right,
would rise.
So the good news is, the new Farm Bill actually is doing away with a lot of that.
Right.
So farmers are going to not getting what we call direct payments.
Right.
Think of a direct payment as it comes to your mailbox.
Yeah.
Sugar farmers don't get any direct payments. They're getting paid the difference between what they think is a fair target price and what the actual price is. We get no price support. We get no price direct payments. What we get is a program that allows us to be 100% competitive within the United States and prevent other countries from dumping sugar into the U.S. market. The point is that you don't want just to be overrun by another continent because they have a policy that overpays their farmers. The United States has a great policy. It's called a cheap food policy. And we are going to do everything we can to overproduce food in this country to keep the price cheap. And we've done a marvelous job.
Explain the economics here a little bit. You've got fewer sugar mills. You've got less acreage to grow sugar.
Mm-hmm.
But yet prices continue to move down. You would figure that fewer mills, less land, would equal lower supply, and demand clearly has stayed the same, if not grown. Prices naturally ought to be going higher.
Well, they did go higher in 2008, 9, and 10.
And all commodities were going higher back then, but partly because of the Great Recession and capital was looking for places to go, not necessarily driven by supply and demand.
Partly it was because you actually had a hurricane hit production in Australia. You had dry weather in Brazil. You know the farmers in India export some years and import others because they do not irrigate their sugar cane. If it doesn't rain, they don't produce a very good crop. So it was weather related that created a shortage worldwide of sugar. As soon as the price started going up significantly, then people started trying to increase their acreage. The acreage in Florida has not increased. The acreage in Louisiana has not increased. The acreage in Fargo, North Dakota has not increased. But we have been able to increase yields. We produce almost 5 tons of raw sugar per acre. So we're a high-yield producer, but you need to increase that. Our yields have actually gone down because of hurricanes in 04 and 05, but also we've had some other issues, disease-related issues. So our production is actually off a little bit.
Rick, you grow vegetables, you grow sugarcane, you are a member of the sugar cooperative. Where is the largest profit margin for you?
It's really hard to explain it that way because it changes every year. Obviously, in 2011, our highest profit margins were in sugar because of the worldwide shortage. The better way to explain from a farmer perspective is risk. To most people, farmers are a little bit crazy. The fact that we go out and borrow millions of dollars, plant seeds in the ground, fertilize it, cultivate it, spray it, and then when we harvest it, we figure out if we made any money or not. And 80% of the time when you harvest vegetables, you are selling it at a loss. Sugarcane is my bond market. The bankers that loan me millions of dollars to farm love that I'm in the sugarcane business because I am within 5% of my profit margin every year in sugarcane. It's a very predictable business. The vegetables is the stock market. You're selling lettuce for $7 a box, 24 heads for $7 a box. The grocery store, that's 33 cents a head. The grocery store is selling it for $1.59. I'm taking a beating most of the time, but every once in a while it's $20 a box and I make a good profit.
If it were not for the price supports, would you still grow sugarcane? Would it still be a good business to be in for you, second generation grower?
Long term, it probably would not be. What we've learned over the years is every time they've done away with the sugar program, they've done it several times. They did it in 74. Which was before my time, and they did it in 81, which I was farming then. Generally speaking, the market becomes more erratic. So the simple answer is, long-term, it probably would be bad for America, because what you'd have is you would have other countries taking away our market, and we'd be dying the death of 1,000 cuts. Incrementally, we would lose share. And if you want to kill a sugar mill, that is how you do it. You decrease the amount of tons going through the mill, and over time, the cost will run you out of business. So that is a bad scenario. What is a more important fact to think about is consistently flat prices paid to the farmer for a commodity, whether it's lettuce, radishes, or sugar, is better for the consumer, but not the retailer.
Rick, what do you think the price of sugar would be without price supports today in 2014?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt. See, one of the problems we're having, there's no doubt that the price of sugar is, as a matter of fact, there have been some sugar sold below 18¾ cents. Now, who are the people who are doing that? The sugar mills in Mexico. See, the sugar mills in Mexico produce raw sugar just like we do. We're only selling 70% of the U.S. consumption because so much additional sugar is coming in under law, WTO law, from 40 countries, plus Mexico can bring in whatever it wants and totally wreck our market. So guess what? Mexico is bringing sugar in and trying to sell it for 18 cents a pound, but they have no place else to sell it, so they bring it in and sell it even cheaper. So the market is being forced down below 18 cents. We are doing that right now.
Palm Beach sugarcane grower and refiner Rick Roth. Now, the trade restrictions on Mexican sugar into the U.S. disappeared back in 2008 under the North American Free Trade Agreement. By the next year, the amount of Mexican sugar imported into the U.S. more than doubled. The flood of Mexican sugar here led to prices higher for sugar in Mexico. By 2010, Mexican sugar imports into the U.S. had dropped then from the previous year, but remained well above the supplies shipped in prior to NAFTA. Still to come on our program, the price supports and the global supply and demand.
The sugar market is one of the most heavily traded markets in the world and one of the most heavily subsidized.
This is the Sunshine Economy, bittersweet, the sugar industry in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Supply and demand is as basic as food. If supply outpaces demand, low prices should be the result. Now, the lower prices would normally lead to lower supply, as producers either go bankrupt or leave the business to look for profit somewhere else. But in the sugar business, low prices in the global market have not led to a drop in global supplies. Kevin Kerr is a trader and managing editor of CommodityConfidential.com.
The sugar market is one of the most heavily traded markets in the world and one of the most heavily subsidized markets in the world. India has huge subsidies, Mexico, the United States, Brazil. I mean, every market that grows sugar has these subsidies in place, and they're a big factor in international trade. Sugar is used in so many things as well, things that we don't even think about on a daily basis, that it's a very, very important commodity, very affected by the weather, and so that's a huge factor when trading sugar.
Kevin, why do so many countries, do you think, provide price supports for their sugar growers?
Well, they're really a necessity to keep prices stable. These subsidies are put in place by governments to protect, really as a protectionism measure, for a key commodity that's exported all over the world. And it's really become kind of an epidemic and a detriment to supplies and demand around the world. We have seen countries like in the EU withdraw those subsidies, and kind of chaos has ensued afterwards, where we've seen prices just plummet, and many of the millers go out of business altogether. So it's really a double-edged sword with the subsidies. Short term, it might be better because it brings down prices, but longer term, we could see much higher prices if the subsidies are removed.
Is sugar fungible? In other words, is sugar grown in Brazil essentially the same sugar that's grown in Palm Beach County?
No, there's different sugars. The main primary futures contract that we trade is called sugar number 11. If you go to a restaurant, sometimes you find that raw sugar versus the white crystalled sugar. So there's differences in milling and growing in various countries, depending on where you are.
What impact do you think all of the international subsidies have on the price of sugar that sugar growers in South Florida can receive and consumers in the United States have to pay?
Well, very good question, Tom. You know, the sugar program is really a complicated maze of, you know, various import quotas and loan programs, you know, all designed to keep the sugar industry afloat, and not only just in the U.S., but elsewhere. And basically, you know, countries like Brazil and Mexico, whose governments have aggressively subsidized their sugar, are facing some tough choices here. The goal of it is to achieve, you know, global dominance in the market by putting these quotas and import quotas and loan programs in place to support farmers. They really want to own the market. The bottom line is, again, subsidies right now will help keep prices keep prices high. And so basically for consumers, it's a negative all around. They get higher taxes because of these subsidies being paid out and higher prices in the sugar aisle when they're at the grocery store. So removing those, a lot of people want those subsidies removed, and let's say that's truly a free market then, we would initially see a huge drop in prices because imports would flood in and push those prices down, which is a positive for consumers. However, the longer-term impact would be that we would see mass closing of mills that simply couldn't compete with those prices. And then longer-term, and we predict if this does happen, longer-term, we would see much higher prices for the commodities going forward. So the subsidies have benefits and detractors, and we have to weigh out which works better.
Kevin, have the subsidies in the United States led to an oversupply of sugar, just too much sugar for the market?
Well, a global glut of sugar right now. We've got a plentiful supply coming out of many markets and in storage. And so we're seeing very depressed prices for sugar over the last few years, certainly last year in 2013. Going forward in 2014, we expect prices to rise maybe as much as 20%, get back up to around the 18-cent level. But significant increases could come in 2015 when these supplies start waning. And certainly if we see more mills close and we see some of these subsidies removed, we expect prices, again, also on the back of very dry weather in key growing areas like Brazil, are not going to affect the 2014 crop so much as they are the 2015 crop, because sugar has about an 18-month growing window, and the dry weather kicked in about December has affected that growing. And so we really could see prices ratchet up in 2015, but we expect to see prices increase as we go in through forward in 2014 as well.
The subsidies act as barriers to send Palm Beach County sugar to Brazil and vice versa. So how much international trade is there in the sugar market?
We see a lot of protectionism in this market. There is international trade. A lot of the countries that do grow sugar turn it right back into ethanol for their own countries and export that or use it domestically. So we do see a lot of usage domestically for sugar in various countries, Brazil, key countries, Brazil, the U.S., et cetera. And those mandates are in place, so by law, a lot of it has to go to that. But, you know, again, the subsidies do hold back international trade, and certainly if they were removed, you would see a lot of it immediately get dumped onto the market here in the U.S. and elsewhere. And similar to what happened in the EU, and I think the repercussion of that would be you'd see many mills in the U.S. domestically go out of business, simply not able to compete.
Do U.S. Sugar growers and sugar millers manufacture more sugar than the domestic market traditionally demands on an annual basis?
They do, and again, the subsidies kick in for that and the different programs to support that, even though we have plentiful supplies of sugar to keep growing it. And this is the problem with subsidies across the board for all types of crops, and when we have an abundance of them. So yeah, right now the government's got plenty of sugar on hand, can't unload much of it to the ethanol buyers. They're just not that interested, and there's just simply plentiful supply right now.
And it goes to certainly the candy companies, but all sorts of food manufacturers, doesn't it?
It does, of course. You know, we find sugar in pretty much every product you can think of. It's a main ingredient. So it is key, and to have this kind of surplus when a product that is so much in use is certainly putting pressure on prices.
What are some of the cost drivers for sugar growers? You know, for livestock, whenever we see an increase in corn or feed prices, obviously that gets kind of washed through the entire food chain. For sugar growers, what are the operational costs that they have to manage?
It's actually, you know, sugar is one of the easier crops to grow. It's not as sensitive as many of the crops other crops that we see that require a lot of input costs. However, the problem is it's very weather sensitive at key stages. So, like I said, the 2015 crop that we're looking at takes about 18 months to mature. Had very, very dry weather in Brazil throughout December and into January, and that's persisting. And it's at a key growing stage, similar to what soybeans go through with the pod stage. If you don't get the water you need at a certain time, or for corn, same thing. If it doesn't come in for sugar at a certain point, you just will lose the entire crop. And so that's the biggest fear for sugar growers, that during this key stage, they're just not going to get the irrigation they need. And of course, if they do have to irrigate, it costs a lot of money. So that's one of the bigger input costs for them.
Kevin, you know South Florida somewhat. You've lived and worked in Palm Beach County. How would you describe the impact of the sugar industry in this region?
Well, it's been pretty dismal. You know, we've seen a lot of the...
Because of low prices?
Well, exactly, because of the low prices have driven some companies out of business completely. And the industry is really kind of fragmented in Florida. It's similar to what we've seen with the orange growers. Same problem, different issue. We've seen a lot of those go away as well, and it continues to soften in the market. And sugar, you know, is a very good commodity to grow in Florida. We should be encouraging that business, and we should see government assistance in that area to help these companies flourish because it's a key growing area.
Still to come on our program, the one-time sugar powerhouse to our south.
What would change the sugar future of Cuba is the Wall Streets of the world.
This is the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Imagine thousands and thousands of acres with moist soil, plenty of sunshine, and regular rainfall. Ideal for sugarcane. In the 1980s, Cuba was the third biggest sugar producer in the world, the biggest sugar exporter. It was the Cold War, and the Soviet Union was buying loads of Cuban sugar. Today, Cuba accounts for less than 1% of the global sugar supply. Juan Tomás Sánchez's family grew sugar and other crops in Cuba before the Communist Revolution. He came to America in 1961 when he was 18 years old. He's retired now and works with the Cuban sugarcane growers in exile and is a member of the Association for the Study of the Cuban Economy.
Throughout, you know, the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century, mostly Cuba was a reliable producer of sugar. The world has changed a lot in the last 40 years. Sugar today, in terms of trade, the 60 million tons that are traded each year, an average price of 400, that's, you know, $24 billion.
And that's a business that Cuba is not really participating in today.
No, it's
certainly not.
Not
with the volume that it had been participating
no,
in.
No, it's not participating.
Generations ago.
Very, very little.
What's the opportunity in the generation ahead or generations ahead that it may have in front of us?
The opportunity is really to be number two. We're not going to be number one. Brazil is number one. We can never match Brazil.
You're saying we.
By meaning Cuba?
Yeah.
Yeah, that I feel that way. We can match and outsource the next largest, you know, largest, which are Australia and Thailand. And the rest, you know, are much... Indonesia, well, Cuba has a potential to have... 5 billion, 6 billion dollars a year trade in sugar. But it's not only sugar, it's what sugar complements. Sugar complements the rest of agriculture because this is a justification. So you can have there the Caterpillars, the John Deere, the General Electric, the Monsanto. You know, the justification is sugar because that's a big business.
Juan, this ideal that you have and the hope that you hold out for the return of Cuba as a global source of sugar, what would that mean for South Florida's sugar industry?
One way would be that the talent here will have another place to go, because right now, if you have a talent here, you could probably go to Louisiana. And you don't want to take your family to Brazil or Guatemala. So most likely will be a challenge for the worker and the executives here. But the biggest challenge will be in banking, in law.
You don't see a resurgence of Cuba's sugar industry as a competitor for growers in Palm Beach County, for instance.
No, because where Cuban sugar is blocked from the U.S. market.
Well, it certainly is now, yes, and has been, obviously, for the better part of a half a century.
And will be, you know. There's no way to break the back of the sugar lobby in the United States. Nobody has that clout.
Still to come on our program, the price supports, the environmental issues, the trade embargoes. It's enough to make a novel villain.
True, some of the big sugar companies were family-owned, but the family members themselves seldom touched the soil. The closest most of them got to the actual crop were the cubes that they dropped in their coffee at the Bankers Club.
This is the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Talking about sugar in South Florida is a lot like talking about politics or religion in polite company. You are sure to stir the pot. Carl Hyacin has been doing that for decades as a Miami Herald reporter and columnist and author of his own unique genre of Florida crime novels. In one of those, Striptease, Big Sugar is the force behind the action of a debauched congressman, his obsession with a divorced mom who strips, and the interests of the Big Sugar family named the Rojos.
Congressman David Lane Dilbeck didn't give much thought to the science or mechanics of cane farming. It was enough that the Rojos were nice people, well-bred, and so generous. The mountainous campaign donations were important, of course, but Dilbeck would have traded his congressional vote for just the occasional use of that gorgeous yacht. He also valued the social company of young Christopher, who shared his tastes in bawdy entertainment and never failed to pick up the tab.
That's from the audiobook version of Hyacin's 1993 Striptease, of course turned into a movie in 1996. As Hyacin, or maybe his publisher's lawyers, writes in the disclaimer of the hardback version, quote, "The events described are purely imaginary, although the accounts of topless creamed corn wrestling are based on fact." We've got more online and on Twitter. Just follow us at WLRN with the hashtag Sunshine Economy. Like it or not, sugar is a staple of the modern diet. And is the cane, sugarcane business is an influential industry for the promise of the South Florida economy and ecology. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Sugar promises and everything nice. Let that be your one.